8. Tina Kellums versus Michael Astru. Hello, Mr. Sutterfield. Come on up. I always feel like a game show host when I say, come on up. All right.
Please the court. I'm Attorney David Sutterfield. I represent Tina Kellums. The Ms. Kellums' case intrigued me. It was not my case initially before the ALJ, and when she contacted me and I saw the medications that she was on, I was floored by my review of the ALJ's decision, where I saw virtually no analysis of the longitudinal history of Ms. Kellums' treatment. Ms. Kellums had been in outpatient mental health treatment in the summer before her alleged onset date, and was in a downward spiral, stopped working in November 2001, and was treating for her multiple impairments, which, as the court notes, she has the fibromyalgia, the depression, anxiety. She subsequently developed the neurofibromatosis and the coronary artery disease. In looking at the record, it was clear, and it is clear, that the ALJ had failed to consider the entire record and had made credibility findings that were based, that were clearly erroneous. And as a consequence, he had failed to adequately develop an appropriate RFC for the claimant and should have taken guidance from the treating physician's opinion, but certainly ended up playing a role of doctor, which is not permitted.
Now, she did continue to perform the relatively strenuous work of caring for her husband's elderly relative for some 18 months after she became, after she says she became disabled. Perhaps that can be explained away.
Well,
but couldn't a fact finder reasonably conclude, as the ALJ did, that this undercuts her credibility as to the, the extent of her limitations?
Well, I think they would if the ALJ had bothered to look at the contemporaneous medical evidence, but he didn't. That's the problem. If you look at Dr. Sigler's findings in March of 2002, inability to lift a left arm, pain throughout and virtually every one of the joints, posture. February of 2002, she's noting that there is abnormal posture, abnormal gait, abnormal balance, abnormal motion of the cervical spine. In March of 2003, Dr. Sigler's noting weak grip, pain with minimal activities, such as curling. That's obviously a subjective report, but pain with using a curling iron, pain with brushing her dog. And in response to that, she's increasing the methadone. You don't see that analysis by the ALJ in terms of, okay, reconciling the conflicts. You say, oh, she was doing this. Let's not look into whether she what she was doing for this 87-year-old. And I think in terms of the characterization of it, it would not be what I would call robust activity. Maybe if she's watching a 3-year-old who is darting around that type of matter. But if someone needs an 87-year-old to be there and keep it as a companion, that certainly allows for an awful lot of respite on the part of the person who's providing the companionship.
But there had to have been lifting and pushing and...
If you're elected, you do what you can. That doesn't equate to 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and it doesn't equate to necessarily she's getting her elderly aunt by marriage up when she needs to get up. She may not have been doing all that terrific a job. Who's going to admit to that? Nobody.
Well, but that's speculation. We can't, you know.
Well, but it's also in terms of when we look at the objective findings by her treating doctor. How is she going to be doing, in essence, what one would equate to be CNA work? She's not. It's simply not feasible in terms of the objective findings made by Dr. Sigler, who's a physiatrist. She's a specialist in how the body works.
And can you speak to this drug-seeking behavior? Because the ALJ seems to put a lot of weight on and said it was really supported by the record, giving certain examples.
Yeah, I think the ALJ's analysis in that regard is poor, to say the least. We have not a single doctor who ever says anything about this drug-seeking behavior at all. So we have Dr. Sigler, Dr. Benyamin, and Dr. McGeff, who are the primary ones here providing her with the medications. Not one of them talks about drug-seeking behavior. The only instance that arose was with respect to Dr. Cook when the claimant had her open heart surgery and she complained about the incisional pain. And he made the mention of drug-seeking behavior. Dr. McGeff, her treating doctor, saw her shortly thereafter, and at page 784 of the record, you'll note that he specifically says, no, there's not an issue there. That's not an issue whatsoever.
They wanted her off these meds, though, didn't they?
And she got off of them. I mean, that's the other part that belies the ALJ's critique, is that she builds up. I mean, she gets on incredible amounts of medication, 200 micrograms of the Durogesic patch with 3,600 milligrams of Neurontin, with hydrocodone, diazepam, Remeron, Valium, Xanaflex, and Topamax, with Darbocet and Vicodin for breakthrough pain. I mean, as the case law indicates, these doctors don't give that out unless they have reason to believe that their patient is credible. And there is no finding to the contrary other than Dr. Cook. And as I noted in the physician's desk reference, it talks about warning about drug-seeking behavior, and it sets forth the criteria, and that's addressed in my brief. And lo and behold, none of that is apparent in the record. We don't see her losing her prescriptions, as noted in the PDR. We don't see her making visits at the end of office hours. We don't see her making ER visits. As a matter of fact, the ALJ found that to be an adverse credibility finding, that she's not going to the emergency room for ER. We don't see her doctor shopping. We see Dr. McGeff and Dr. Sigler sending her out and saying, gee, you need to see some other people. You need to see Dr. Benyamin. Well, traveling to and from Bloomington became a problem. You need to see Dr. Black. Lo and behold, the referring clinic couldn't even find Dr. Black. They themselves. That's documented on page 315 of the record. Carl Pavilion wouldn't take her for mental health. She couldn't go to Barnes because of the medical. I'm sorry, Carl Pavilion wouldn't take her for mental health treatment because of the medical card issue. Barnes Hospital in St. Louis wouldn't take her because of the medical card issue. Dr. Furry reviewed her records at Dr. McGeff's request and said, you're treating her fine. That's at page 302 and 310 of the record. She was asked to attend an exercise class. She did. She had to cut it back. And, in fact, Dr. Sigler wrote a note saying, okay, you got to cut it back. She herself stopped the Topamax because it was making her drowsy. She couldn't get an EMG because of insurance. She couldn't get the nerve block because of insurance. She decreased her own dosage of methadone in January of 2003 from 5 tablets to 4 because of difficulty she was having getting up in the morning. She stopped taking a Darbocet on her own, and that she noted that that actually increased her pain control. She was interested in functioning better. She complained of feeling drunk. This isn't, you know, this is the antithesis of drug-seeking behavior. And so there's the notation about, well, gee, she's referred to a psychiatrist and she doesn't go. Put yourself in her position. You're given these powerful narcotics and all of a sudden say, oh, gee, maybe this is in your head. Go see some, you know, like, wait a minute, how did you lead me down this path with these powerful addictive medications? Yeah, you're not exactly going to find somebody to say yes, sir, and give them a salute, and off down the road they go marching with that kind of treatment. Trying to think of other issues that are pertinent. I can save them for a rebuttal because their credibility findings, I go down each and every one of them, they're simply not supported by the record. And what happens then is now the judge is going to come in and play doctor. I'll save my remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Goldstein. I can finally say it. Good afternoon, Mr. Goldstein.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Appellant has placed much weight in the court, has devoted significant attention to appellant's narcotic use this afternoon. But the ALJ didn't base his decision only on narcotics. In fact, the ALJ looked at five or six other factors. And while we believe that the ALJ's finding on narcotics is well supported, we'd like to focus this afternoon on those other factors that the ALJ considered.
But here's one problem. If we thought that part of the ALJ's rationale for his decision to discredit her was problematic, why wouldn't the proper course be for us to remand to revisit the credibility determination? Suppose that we thought that the ALJ's finding that she engaged in this drug-seeking behavior was clearly erroneous. How could we separate out that aspect of his adverse credibility determination from the other reasons that the ALJ cited? I mean, no matter what you would say, and I know you're going to be good at it, but no matter what you would say, how would we know if it's 90%, 80%, 20%?
There's no way of knowing what percent, unless the ALJ said what percent, I think, as the court's saying. But the one thing that the court has done in the past, it doesn't have to find every single one of the ALJ's credibility factors to be supported by substantial evidence, just find that credibility finding as a whole to be supported by substantial evidence. And I think that what the court would then do is have to consider, you know, how much is that, was that erroneous, clearly erroneous finding an element of the ALJ's decision. I don't know if that's how it's possible, and but I think the court would just have to sort of try to get a feel for that decision and see what's going on and what do a sort of a balancing there, perhaps. I can't think of a decision that addresses that exact point. There are, of course, a whole line of harmless error decisions, but I think what the court's suggesting is maybe that's not, it doesn't fit in nicely into that line of decisions.
Yeah. I must say, in all of my years on the bench, today's the first time that two cases where we have people on methadone. It's very wow. I mean, I know you see this all the time, but I've been around for 26 years. And I just, I've seen quite a few Social Security cases. It's amazing to me.
But, there is a line of narcotic abuse cases in the recent decisions by the court. Similar, a 2009 case, and Berger, a 2008 case. And I think the other outstanding factor about this case is that when she's taking methadone, well, of course, while she's taking methadone, multiple doctors are telling her, get off, and she's not interested. And that sounds like narcotic-seeking behavior. When you're under the care of a physician for methadone and you go to a hospital emergency room and ask for more methadone, I think an ALJ could reasonably find that sounds like narcotic-seeking behavior. When you're under prescribed care and you start taking your husband's narcotic medication, I think an ALJ could find that's narcotic-seeking behavior. And it's not just the Seventh Circuit. Decisions from the Eighth Circuit in Anderson, the Tenth Circuit in Papa, this narcotic-seeking behavior is a whole line of decisions.
Now, he stops taking the methadone in 2004 and agreed to try to eliminate all extraneous medications in May 2006.
And that's right, and that's already getting pretty, you know, that's already five, from 2001 to 2006, five of the 6 years under consideration. It takes her until then to finally agree to get off the medication. But even then, and there was an allegation this morning, she stopped Topamax on her own. But if we look at page, I believe, 750 of the record, Dr. Megat, her treating physician, says she didn't stop Topamax or Midrin as directed. So even in 2006, as late as 2006, she's still not stopping her medications as directed by her treating physician.
But then there's this issue with the therapy and getting physical therapy, and the issue there was, as I understand it, an insurance coverage problem.
It's
right, and she didn't participate. It's not really totally clear from the record why that is, but
well,
that has some bearing too on this drug behavior.
Well, right, in August of 2006, Dr. Syed, who she went to on her own, and one of her physicians recommended she pursue physical therapy, and I think the record just says she declined physical therapy. There's no, I mean, when she's getting as much care as she's getting, and I left the record at the table because it's so big. I mean, it's just, you know, it's this big. There's this much medical records. It's hard to believe a credible claim that she doesn't have access to treatment. So I think the ALJ could reasonably consider this not wanting to get physical therapy treatment. Her doctor saying you need mental health care treatment. Her not seeking that. So the ALJ can consider these failures, these shortcomings and shortfalls under Schmidt, for instance.
Even if people can't afford it.
No, not if people can't afford it, but as I suggested, that this record doesn't suggest that she didn't have access to health care.
As I understood it, this physical therapy was supposed to be in a home program, and there are different insurance plans. Some cover that and others don't. And at least that's what I gleaned from her argument, that it wasn't covered and she couldn't afford it.
There are other, I mean, maybe she couldn't afford that particular physical therapy program, it would appear, though, from Dr. Syed's report that he just was talking to her, and he saw her one time at her request, and he said that she just refused physical therapy care. And it would seem to me somewhat incredible that she would know at a doctor's visit what her insurance covered and what her insurance didn't cover. She just said, no, I don't want it.
Of course, she was someone, like you said, very experienced. She had, you know, tons of medical records, so maybe she was familiar with it.
It's certainly possible, but again, Dr. Syed didn't say she can't afford the treatment. Dr. Syed said she refused to seek the treatment. The ALJ also considered the objective medical evidence. There was normal MRIs, normal motor function, normal muscle tone, normal gait. Some of the evidence that was cited this morning was from 2002, and as Judge Rovner and I believe Judge Williams also noted, she was working at the time. She was doing significant work. She was working 50 to 60 hours a week. She wasn't just sitting there. She said she lifted this elderly woman 18 to 25 times a day for toileting. That's not something that an ALJ, or that is something that an ALJ could reasonably consider. She also was a full-time student in 2002. The ALJ could reasonably conclude, based on these findings and all of the findings in the record and all the activities in the record and the doctor's comments, we believe that the LJ could reasonably conclude that she could perform a range of work and under the vocational expert's testimony was therefore not disabled.
Thank you very much. Does 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. Dr. Syed did not recommend physical therapy. He recommended she go to physical medicine. That's a department. That's a doctor. That's the department that Dr. Lee Siegler is in.
I know, but physical medicine, I've never seen a physiatrist that doesn't want you to have physical therapy.
Right. And in the records, it talks about her having gone and Dr. Siegler having given her a note to reduce her participation in physical therapy. That's in the chart. That's in the record. It's cited in my brief. But Dr. Syed, who is referenced by counsel, did not refer her to physical therapy. That's simply not accurate. The personal observations made by the ALJ at the hearing, nothing in the record to support that. Under what circumstances was she raising her arm? She described her pains at 10. Well, Dr. Benyamin, she said her pains 8 at best, 9 is worse, and presently was a 7. She doesn't have a very good clue on how to rate her pain.
She testified that it was a 10.
Correct.
On average, which the ALJ found incredible.
Right.
Certainly a reasonable inference.
But the thing is that the ALJ doesn't describe what does that mean, you know, in terms of that. I've seen people say, describe your pain as a 0 to 10, and they say a 12. And other people say a 5, and what do you mean by that? And you push, you find out, well, that means I'm having severe pain.
I thought the ALJ gave the usual definition, 0 being no pain and 10 being the most excruciating pain that is totally debilitating, requiring emergency room or physician treatment. And in response to that question, she said it's on average a 10, which is just incredible, not worthy of belief.
But if you put it in the context, if this same individual is at Dr. Benyamin's office and asked to rate her pain, not under the pressure of a hearing, and she says, well, it's 8 at its best, it's 9 at its worst, and currently it's a 7.
She understood what was at stake at this hearing.
She might have understood what was at stake in terms of she's trying to convey, I have severe pain. There's no mistaking, sir, I have
severe
pain.
And she's been given this question repeatedly throughout the course of her treatment, because that's usually what doctors start with when they have a pain case like this, right?
And we see...
And so she knows the import of that question, and she's answered it multiple times in the past. And so the ALJ is entitled to take that response and factor it in the credibility assessments here.
To try to
ask us to discount that is not very credible.
Well, I would simply from the standpoint when someone asks and say, do you always talk like that? She obviously has the appearance of someone who's drunk at the hearing. And ALJ managed to ignore that. So
I thought you said she got off all her meds.
No.
That's what you said in your opening argument.
No. When she was directed to get off of certain meds, for example, when she was directed to get off the Duragesic patch, she did that. When she was directed to get off the methadone, she did that. She got a phone call. The doctor said, well, I'm going to tell you how to do it by phone. That was it. No counseling, no nothing. When she shows up the ER, as mentioned by counsel, looking for the methadone, as Dr. McGeff, they called Dr. McGeff and said, hey, I'll get it for you. Because why? Because she is stepping down from it. She was out, and no one was prescribing it. Stepping down means you have to have it to step down. She didn't have it. She went to the ER. McGeff ordered it. She then followed up with Sigler's office. They did the pill count, and guess what? It was accurate. She was not cheating on her meds. So she did what they asked her to do. So that was my response. When they said get off these certain meds, yes, she did. And other times, she specifically said, I was taking this. I'm getting off it because of the side effects. I don't like them. I want to live a life.
Well, I think I have to throw you out now. All right. Thanks to all concerned, and the case will be taken under advisement.